My name is Mary and I am an alcoholic. And I'm most delighted to be here. My dry date is the 10th of August, 1984. And I have a sponsor who is Clancy. And I am an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I would like, first of all, to thank Dick and Barbara for inviting me here and putting on this wonderful weekend. I mean, so far it has been as usual, absolutely. It seems to get better every year. I don't know. And, you know, I think they deserve a hand for what they do. And I'd like to thank Louis and Patrick who go out and get us all those goodies. You know, that's very nice, and it's nice to see Lee and everybody else who's here. And I'm doing Made a Searching and Fearless Moral Inventory of Myself. Step 4. How can I, who has lived an immoral life all my life, make a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself? That was a great dilemma for me. Because, you see, it wasn't just when I drank that I was a bad girl. I had been a bad girl long before I drank. And I don't know why, and I have pondered that. I have pondered why I was so immoral. Because I came from a very good Roman Catholic family. My mother was president of the Union of Catholic Mothers. My father was a Franciscan monk who had left the monastery not for any bad reason, but just because he had a dispute and he decided to go. I had wonderful grandparents. I was taught everything that was right, and I didn't have any ability for it whatsoever. From I can trace back, from I was 7, I decided that if I wanted something, I would take it. If it belonged to you, too bad. I used to think maybe it's because I was born during the war and things were rationed and I never got what was really should have been coming to me. You know, maybe I was just deprived, like even something like candies were rationed. But I don't know why. But all I'll tell you is this. About age 7, I stole an apple. Like in the Bible, that was the beginning of the end for me. My family were very concerned about me because I lied when I didn't have to lie. And I stole, and they knew I was stealing because I was stealing money from my mother's purse and putting it in my shoe. Nobody ever showed me how to steal money and put it in my shoe. It came naturally. It just came naturally. So my family said, maybe she will reach the age of reason when she has her first Holy Communion. Age 7, if you're a Catholic, you have your first Holy Communion. Well, on the day of my Holy Communion, we were all changing in the classroom. My veil blew out the window, and I stole somebody's veil. There seemed to be no redemption. No redemption. If I'm making a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself, that means I'm going to be look at myself. You see, my entire life, from I can remember, had been an escape from self. I seemed to be suffocated in self. I wanted to escape myself. I did not know that I could change myself. You see, I had an unbearable, intolerable, unsheddable burden of self. I was suffused with self. I was my own self-regulating, self-contained ecosystem. There was nothing out there. And not only that, but I was afraid of self. I became afraid of myself. And my entire journey from before I drank, when I got into all the bad behavior was an escape from self. Father Red Dowling, when he first went to see Bill W., he was talking about the regeneration that comes when we leave the old self and we find the new. And that is what I wanted. I wanted to find a new self. You see, eventually when I drank, I was able to escape myself. How am I going to live with myself consciously? It was a great bafflement to me, and I did not know how to do it. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I had lost everything of value in my life. I had the morals of an alley cat. I had no morals. I was so ashamed of the things I had done, and that was another great bafflement to me. For a long time, I was not really too much ashamed of the things I've done. I would have been ashamed to tell you about the things I've done. And there was a great dilemma inside of me. I wanted to do good things. For example, when I went into nursing, I wanted to do good things. I wanted to help people. And yet, if the patients had something I liked, I stole it. I'm so ashamed to say that. And yet I'm able to say it to you because that's exactly what I was like. When I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and eventually got into the third step, something profound happened to me that day, and I've spoken about it many times, but I will just tell you that the morning after my last drink, I had a slip, and I truly believe it's this. And I'm not criticizing the sponsor I had, but she did not think that I was ready to go into the steps. She thought that I needed some time to recuperate because I was not in good shape when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it's like I said to my old sponsor once, you know, I was never 13-stepped. All my sponsees are being 13-stepped. She said, do you remember what you looked like when you came in? She said, we used to take you to meetings in a shopping cart, you know. I was not in good shape when I came in here. But anyway, she thought that because I'd been in mental institutions and I'd been on a lot of psychiatric medication, she thought I needed some time without doing anything but the first step. But I will tell you, for 4 months of my initial sobriety, all I was doing was not drinking. I was suffused by hatred for the life I had, for losing my children, for ending up on the street, for the degradation and the despair and the humiliation. I was suffused with guilt because both my parents had died, and before I drew a sober breath, I couldn't bear consciousness. And the horrible thing about it was the living hell of that conscious state was that I couldn't sleep. I didn't sleep. And I'm awake all night. You know, in AA, we think we're okay, but really we're here because we're not all there. Because when I was talking to people about not sleeping, and actually, I even had thoughts of suicide in that early sobriety. And then I started beginning to see what people were doing. And it's so funny. I mean, if a normal person had said to me, so Mary, how are you feeling? I'll say, well, last night I felt really suicidal, but I had a couple of Mars bars and I called my sponsor. They'd look at me like I was crazy. You know? But I was beginning to get some direction and listen to it. But I wasn't dealing with why do I have an inability to tolerate sobriety? Why? Why is it so difficult for me to live a conscious state? Because I hate myself. And when I am conscious, everything I've ever done is sitting right here. And it is unbearable to me, and I have to drink for oblivion. That is why I cannot bear consciousness. That is why the entire 12 steps is about this change of personality. I have to lose the old self and find a new one. And I said to an old woman once, how do I change? She said, you'll never stay sober if you don't change. I said, how do I change? She said, let me tell you how you start. You quit doing the things you don't like yourself for, and you start doing the things that you do like yourself for. And that seems so profound to me. And she was a woman that I admired, because she was very much like me. She was a woman who had come from the street. She was a very spiritual woman. I remember one day hearing her sing her song, and it was about God and the life she had. Just speaking from the podium, from her heart. She was singing to God. And I went up to her afterwards and I said, you know, who are you? Where have you come from? I want to know a little bit more. And she said that, you know, she made me laugh because she said, you know, probably you were like me. I never went to bed with an ugly man, but I sure woke up with a few. She said, but I don't do it anymore because I am a lady in Alcoholics Anonymous and because I have changed. So I had this slip because life was, sobriety was too unbearable. I was going to end up back in the mental institution, but it was a different thing this time, not drinking, because I didn't have any medication inside of me. And I cannot bear life. I realized that part of me, for me, part of this thing called alcoholism that I seem to have had from the get-go and just needed to be activated by a little alcohol, it was an inability to tolerate real life the way other people can. There's just something missing in my DNA. My natural habitat is Disney World. I do not like life. It's just blah. I always need more of something. You know, and there was, you know, I used to feel like a leprechaun in a Presbyterian church. Born in Scotland, and they're also dour, and there's no magic. And then I'd go to Ireland looking for magic, and in Ireland they'd say, she's not right, you know. And if you're not right in Ireland, you're not right anywhere. You know, it's an open-air asylum, you know. There's no peace to be had for me. I used to think I could escape through sex. But you see, I had an obsession with death. And I remember going out with this guy, and he was getting very passionate with me afterwards, and in the middle of his passion, I said to him, so what do you think about death? You know, I just didn't think like other. He said, I think you should go home, you know, but I just didn't think like other people. I did not act like other people. I was not like other people. You know, and I've said it a million times. I always knew there was something seriously wrong with me because people were always saying to me, there's something seriously wrong with you. So, my life has been like a tornado roaring its way through the path and lives of others. Hearts are broken, sweet relationships are dead. I have all of that right in front of me. What am I going to do now? Something happened to me on that morning after my slip when the girl knelt down and said the third step prayer with me, and the images I had in my mind, and there seemed to be some kind of an internal surrender. There seemed to be some kind of a being broken open. I don't understand how it happened. William James, who wrote The Varieties of Religious Experience, and who went and examined all these Skid Row bums, Jerry McCauley, the Water Street Mission, it's all in the varieties of religious experience. All of these Skid Row bums overnight had had some change of personality. Something profound had happened to them. And they had found God. And they never ever drank again. And they were doing good deeds in their community and their society. And he went up to them and he said to them, "What happened to you?" And the common denominator in each and every one is that they had reached a place of absolute and complete despair. And I believe that the despair that I felt after that slip was the thing that cracked me open and created an aperture for God's grace. It also created in me a sense of mea culpa, my fault. In the 12 and 12, it says we have to take the word blame out of our vocabulary and throw it away. I realized I could no longer blame anybody for the things I had done in my life. No matter if they were, in some way, they had blame. You know, it didn't matter. How did that affect my behavior? I can no longer use my husband's I mean, I had my own opinion about them, but that's not what the book said. So being convinced that self manifested in various ways was the root of my problem, I am now in the process of discarding that old self. And I will tell you what I did. When I had my slip and came back, and my dry date is the 10th of August 1984, I had a new openness. I had a new thing going on inside of me that I have never been able to describe, but it was almost instantaneous from when we said that third step prayer. It was a willingness, it was an openness, it was a humility, it was a teachability. And I think it came again through seeing that I was to blame, and it didn't matter what anybody else had ever done in my life, that it was all about me. And if I was going to continue living in this world, and before I died, have an opportunity to make amends to my sons who were taken away from me at such an early age, and for all the other things and the terrible havoc I had created in life, then I better get down and look at the causes and conditions that had caused me to behave like this. And what I did, I got shingles. Sobriety was really horrible for me. I got shingles. it was bad, and I wouldn't take any medication. And I saw what Bill had done once when he had written the 12 steps, and he'd taken a piece of pencil and a foolscap and sat down and written. That's what I did. I was 5 weeks sober, and I sat in bed. And I wrote down there everything that I could remember, everything that was sitting here. It wasn't quite according to the book, but it was everything that I had ever done that I could remember that bothered me, that was always present, and that had created such a self-hatred in me and was causing me to destroy lives. I had a desire to live. You know, what is desire? Desire comes from a very deep place. You know, there's no spiritual Viagra. You cannot create desire. I think that desire is something that it's almost like faith. I'm not talking about the desire that we have, like sexual desire. I'm talking about the desire that comes from deep, deep within. That desire to change. I think it's a gift, and I think I got it when I opened myself to God and was willing to look at me. But I believe it came from the gift of desperation. You know, Harry Thiebaud was talking about the alcoholic, and he felt that, he said, you know, some of the things is that he could see that he had always put himself first, and I could see then that I had always put myself first. It was always about me. It was never about anybody else. That I had been a fraud all my life. Yes, I had. My husbands, all of them, had married figments of my imagination, or theirs. I could be anything they wanted me to be. There was nothing real about me. I wanted to be real. I had that desire to be real. I had that desire to stand in front of somebody and say, "This is who I am." and not feel as if I got too close to you, you'd find out who I really was. I wanted it to come from a deep, deep place so I can stand in front of you and you see me. And I'm okay because everything I'm presenting to you is what I am. I want it to be the what you see is what you get in a good way. So this desire in me, where did it come from? I have no idea, but it was there. And I sat down and I wrote out everything that was deep, deep within me that was causing me so much pain and problem. In my life, in my inability to live life. And there is something about putting pen to paper that is a very spiritual thing. It's also taking me out from the internal thing and putting it on paper, where it can look even more horrific. And when you get a stream of consciousness, sometimes when you're writing, you get a stream of consciousness. And you start writing and more and more and more comes up. And that is exactly what happened to me. I sat that day writing down everything that I could ever think of where I had caused harm to another person. I wasn't so interested in seeing what they had done to me. For some reason, it didn't matter anymore. Now, I went back and I've done other fourths and fifths and then, but at that time, it mattered nothing. My darling mother, because of the grief I caused her, used to call me a bad seed, a bad egg. And she was absolutely right to call me that. She had every reason because of the humiliation I caused her. I'm 40 years old when I do this. 40. There was a lot of years back then that I had to go through that had been sitting and coming around with me because I could never completely escape them. When I was 15 and I'd been thrown out the convent for my bad behavior because I hit a nun, and I've been making amends to nuns ever since, you know, but I got a job because my mother said, I don't know where you're going to end up. And I have a terrible fear that it's not going to be a good place. And she said, I want you to work because I don't think the sitting around is going to be any good for you. She knew that much. And I got a job. And because I didn't think they were paying me enough money, I cooked the books. Nobody has ever shown me how to cook books. And I did it. And I got fired. And they called my mother up again. When my mother died, she died of ovarian cancer. And while she was dying, I had called her on the phone from Jamaica in a drunken, horrific state. And she died of ovarian cancer. My father, one night, said, I don't know where my lassie is. I don't know where my grandkids are. Went for a walk and dropped dead in the street. At the same time, I was living on the street. Never mind all the actions I'd taken. What can I ever do for my parents? How can I make this good? Well, I had a desire to do it. And I went about. The recuperative power of the ego is an amazing thing. And when I'm sitting down trying to be egoless, there comes back into me the fact that, well, maybe you weren't so bad. And I can't sit in judgment of myself because I don't know. I realize now that I am no longer able to judge myself because I have no idea what type of person I really am. I want to go up to you and ask you, what kind? You know, Sheldon, for example, he told me yesterday, I still don't really know who I am. I was having a conversation with Sonia, and I said to her, I just love your music so much, it's so beautiful. beautiful. It made me cry. And Sheldon, who shouldn't have been listening, said, he said, that's not like you, is it? You don't cry easy. And then I was thinking of myself as a sensitive, gentle, new person. Right, Sheldon? So, what do I suffer from? I suffer from defiant individuality and grandiosity. That is the nature of my illness. Defiant individuality. And Bill Wilson spoke about an index of my maladjustments. I like that. That's what I'm putting down. An index of my maladjustments. The things that have had me maladjusted to life all my life. The things that have separated me from you. The things that have made life so unbearable to me because I can't bear myself. And you know, when you can no longer lose yourself in liquor, where are you going to go? Once upon a time, I could escape myself in liquor. Before the liquor happened in my life, I could escape myself through a hedonistic way of life. I kept running away and I kept taking myself along. I was changing people, places and things long before I drank. Why? I look at other people and they look like they're having good normal lives. I know they haven't done the things I've done. I know that. So what is it that's given me this criminal way of life? I want to know. And you know, I might never know. I might never know what gave me that criminal mindset, because that's what it was. A criminal mindset. I have no idea. You could say when I stole that apple, I started on the evil trek. I knew the difference between, that's the difference. I knew what was good and what was not good. This great transformation that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous is a wondrous thing. I don't see any place else in the world where you can take somebody like me, and I'm only talking about me, and be able to transform them from somebody who lived the way I used to live in the way I live today. I like how I live today. I live an open life. I don't do any of the things I used to do. It is a freeness beyond belief, because I was not free before. I was tied to an old vision of who I was. Because when you start on that road, it doesn't stop. It continues and continues and continues. And I think that's one of the reasons why Bill Wilson went and saw that murderer, who was it, Chessman? And spoke to him about the criminality that exists within all of us. I think it's in Passeron or one of those books there. Resentments, when I did that first, were not a big part of my story anymore, because I had the mea culpa. But I realized eventually that resentment was what had caused me to do everything I'd ever done. I seemed to have an ability for resentment from I was very, very young. So now I have all of this written down in paper. What am I going to do? Now, I did not trust you yet in AA. I still didn't think you'd been what I've been and done the things I've done. So who am I going to do this fifth step? Well, I read in the big book what it says. A lot of times we do it with a person who is, you know, if we're religious. Well, I wasn't religious, but I wanted to do it with a priest. I didn't have a good motive. I thought, let me drop all this stuff back where I think it belongs, you know. So I called, I went to the Al-Anon Club and I saw that there was a priest who did fifth steps. And he was also a member of AA. And I called him. Because actually I had done that before I had written my fourth, because there was a lot of wisdom in what I was told in Edmonton. They said, before you do your fifth step, call and make an appointment for your fourth. Because a lot of times people wander around doing this fourth, and the fifth never ever gets done. So I had called this priest, and he said I'd be glad if I came down there. I'm taking him my spiritual disease. And I could think of no better place to take it. I had lost God a long time ago. I think part of the reason for my darkness of the soul was that I had separated myself from God a long, long time ago. And I don't know why that was, but I had a vision of God that was not good, if there was a God. And I preferred to think there wasn't a God. You know, my family, every year when they take me to Ireland, they used to take me to this old cathedral. And on the cathedral, there was a glass case. And it had the head of a martyred saint in there, who had been hung, drawn, and quartered and burnt by the English. They couldn't think of enough things to do to this poor Irishman. So there's this head, it's been sitting inside this glass case for 300 years. But it's still got teeth. And my family used to sit me in front and say, I want you to study St. Oliver Plunkett. Study him. Because he really loved God. I thought, if he really loved God, I want something more than that. Look what happened to him. You know. God and me were far, far, far away. But I have a desire now for God. I have a desire for God, and the way I'm going to find him is through the 12 steps. I've done the third step prayer. I didn't know what I was saying, but something profound happened. There's something going on in me because I don't want to drink anymore. In my early days of sobriety, I heard this and it struck me very deeply. It said, when Michelangelo was carving the old statue of David, somebody went up to him and said, how did you carve that statue out of that old piece of marble? And Michelangelo said, I just chipped away the parts that weren't David. And I think that what I was doing with the 12 steps was I was chipping away the things that I had accrued, the muck and the crud that I had acquired over a lifetime. Took it down because I do think that this is a great program of alchemy. This is alchemy that is practiced. When Bill Wilson said Alcoholics Anonymous is not a success story, rather it is a chronicle of our colossal human failure turned to usefulness by the divine alchemy of a loving God. What is alchemy? Well, in the old days, people used to think they were trying to convert lead into gold. But that's not what they were doing. They were trying to convert the blackness of the soul into the light. Trying to convert the darkness of the soul into the light. And that's what I'm trying to do. And I'm not going to get this thing by sitting around lighting candles. I see some people, rather than do a four step, they'll sit by themselves in the dark and light a candle and meditate. That's just me and a candle. There's nothing. I got to light the candle from the inside. I got to light up the darkness from the inside. That's where I have to start, with enlightenment. The enlightenment that I want, that for some reason my Catholic religion wasn't able to give me. I used to go to confession when I was young. Do you think I'm going to tell the priest what was going on with me? Mm-mm. I want him to like me. Because when I still used to go to church, I was a suck. Suck for approval. So fear has been an evil and corroding thread that has permeated every area of my life. I have been a very fearful person. I've been fearful, and it's made me do a lot of things I'm very ashamed of. Because I'm always trying to protect this fragile thing that doesn't look fragile to you, that looks like it can handle myself. The last time I was in a mental institution, after I'd been there and they'd settled me down, the psychiatrist came to me and said, we're going to send you for assertiveness therapy. I said, I don't need assertiveness therapy. I'm in here because I tried to kill my husband. He said, that's not assertiveness, Marie. That's aggressive. He said, alcoholics do not have enough self-esteem to be assertive. And that's why they are aggressive. I want to have self-esteem because I want to be assertive. I want to be able to move in the world without feeling that everybody, because with what I had inside of me, all the fear, I am completely paranoid. And I think everybody's out to get me. And I don't want to wander the world. Also, I don't want to just go out when it's dark. Also, I want to feel the sunshine on me one more time. Because I've been hiding for a long time. I don't have the words to tell you what it was like for me at the bottom of Lincoln Road on Miami Beach when I was living there. I can't tell you that because it's beyond words. And also, they say some things are too deep for tears. There are some things that are too deep for tears. But I'm going to be able to live with all of that. All of it. Every single thing I ever did in my life, there was a price for it because I got it all back. I got it all back. And I want to divest myself of it and get rid of it. See, these steps 4 and 5 are so important to me because they were the way to a new life. I don't think I could have had the life I've had today if these had been... I don't know. I couldn't have lived with myself. These are the steps to freedom for me, where I know I have a chance again. And when I can come into the rooms of AA and see all these beautiful women and beautiful men and know that I belong and it's a place in here for me. So step 5, I'm going to admit to God, to ourselves and to another human being the exact nature of my wrongs. And I went to that priest and I sat down with him and he just let me free talk. And I spoke and spoke and spoke. And he was a kind, gentle man. And every now and then I wanted to shock him. I just wanted to get a reaction out of that beautiful, tranquil face. A little, but it didn't happen. It didn't happen. He was there for me. This is the greatest step to take an ego reduction. That's why we don't just do it by ourselves. And there is something about the spoken word. When you sit down and you speak it out, for some reason it's gone. Whereas if you were just sitting with yourself reading it, it's still in there. That's the writing part. There's very much an inner process. The 4th step, that's the inner process. The 5th step is the outer. I'm now giving it out into the world and I'm letting it go. I'm going through a humbling experience and I needed to be humble because no matter where I'd gone, I had what Thibaut spoke about, inflated ego and low self-esteem. Inflated ego and low self-esteem. So I need the humbling of it. And I sit down with this priest and have the 3 admissions to God, to myself and to another human being. That's exactly what I'm doing. I'm making 3 admissions. And he sat and he there was one time he said to me, I sense a little rationalization there. And I wanted to say, shut up. Don't criticize me. And he said to me, alcoholics have they're the greatest rationalizers in the world. He said, you don't even know you're doing it, but you're rationalizing there. Let's just keep going the way you've been going because you've been doing real good. And I kept on, and I can't remember how long I was in there, but I was in there a long time. And when he finished, he said to me, is that everything you have to say? And I said, it is.
And he shared a little bit about himself with me, and he shared a little similarities in some of the things I had done. And that just blew me away to think that a priest... that a priest understood my mind. And he said, this is the beginning of my true kinship with God. And it absolutely was. You know, it was so profound for me when I came out of that, being with that priest. This is how I love the symbolic life. I love the things that have meaning. I did that in downtown Edmonton. In downtown Edmonton, there's big buildings, and there's a lot of darkness. You know, the streets are in shadow. And when I came out of there, I crossed over to the sunny side of the street. That's how good I felt. I felt that I had left a ton of baggage. And you know, one would hope that a lot of the stuff I had left there would never reoccur with me, that it was gone forever. Because part of my great defects was rage. This capacity I had for rage that was so deep and so troubling and had caused other people so much damage in my life. But, you know, I spoke about this, but 3 years ago, I had to do another intensive fourth and fifth, just on rage. What had happened to me is I was working for this woman that God had put in my life to test my serenity level. And I used to go into work and she'd throw files at me. And I could imagine myself picking them up and wrapping them around her face. But instead I was my AA good self, and I'd say, you shouldn't do that, you might hurt yourself, you shouldn't worry so much, you know. And anyway, one day I must have decided it was enough, and I went in there. And she started on at me as I walked in the door. And something happened, and it was just her and I, and I went to close the front door so that I could confine her in this little office with me. And before I closed the door, I said to God, God, I'll see you when I come out. And I took her inventory from when she was born. And I lost it. And I was suffused in, you know that, I don't know if you've had it, but it's like my kids used to call me napalm. It's like, it's a rage, and then it's gone. And it sucks everything out of you. And it all goes on to this other poor soul who's there. And when I finished this tirade, she was sitting cowering in her chair, and she said, I think you should go home, I've got work to do. No, she said, I think you should go home. I said, no, you go home, I've got work to do. And she left. And when she left, I knelt down and I asked God to forgive me. And I called my sponsor, who was Norma at that time. My sponsor Norma died in May, and that's when I went to Clancy. I called Norma and she said, you're always staying in relationships past the expiry date. She said, what I want you to do is to go in tomorrow morning with dignity, make amends, and give her a week's notice. I did that. And so then Norma said, you know, this rage has come up a couple of times. Clancy won't remember, but this, when he was sponsoring me, when I was about, still married to my husband, and I was about 9 years sober. I hate to say this, but I will. I was cutting roast beef, and my husband started on at me, and I took the knife to him, but I did not pierce flesh. I called Clancy. So you see, that rage has been there for a long, long time. And I did that intensive fourth and fifth on the rage. And what we discovered was something way, way back in childhood, either real or imagined, because I don't remember, that had made me feel impotent, powerless, or whatever it was that that woman was making me feel. And it struck a very deep place. And I had never looked at that before. And that is what I have found. You know, I do the 10 step all the time, but I have found that sometimes when some emotion reoccurs often, I have to look to see what really was the root of that. Why have I kept this behavior going on? I am glad to tell you, sex used to be a big problem for me. Sex used to move me around. I mean, move me around as in country to country. In pursuit of my passion of the moment. You know, it's one of the deadly sins for me. I used to think I was in love. I realize I have never... I love my kids, but I'm talking about... I've been in lust. Because what would happen to me is I'd fall in love. Him and I would be like Velcro. We'd get married. And after 2 months, I can hear him breathing 3 doors down. Did he always breathe like that? You know. Did he always take his soup? So you see, Polly and Dave did a beautiful thing on love. I've been too full of self to ever have that. I haven't had that. I don't know how to compromise. I don't know how to. And if you expect me to, you married the wrong girl. You know. And of course, everybody expects compromise. There's just something within me, and Clancy had said it to me a long time ago. He said, some of us are just not meant to be married. He meant, you know, the Jesuits told me that. The Jesuits told me, the Jesuits, I haven't spoken about this before, but the Jesuits wanted to do something on me. They wanted to find out how I ticked. Because I'd made little intermittent forays into the church, and you know, they were saying, well, we can get you back into the church if you really want to come. You've been married 4 times, but, you know, write parts of your life to us. Every time I write something of my life, it's the end for me. I wrote all my story down, and they said to me that I belonged in DSM-3 at the time. And that I should never have been married, ever. Clancy did the final. When I moved down to Jamaica from Toronto, my sponsor told me to go and make amends to the island. And I went back to Jamaica. And before I left, you know, I'd been living a good life. But I just became very fearful. Like, that evil and corroding thread was back in me again. That fear that permeates my being. And I thought, if I go back to where I used to drink, I'm going to end up on the street again. I'm going to end up drinking. I'm going to end up doing this and this and this. And Renee said to me, when you go to Jamaica, call Clancy. She said, I've never lived on the street. I've never been in mental institutions, but Clancy has. And when I went down to Jamaica, I called Clancy. And Clancy said, why don't you write a little piece about your life? And I did. And at that time, I faxed it. That shows you how long ago that is. Do you know what a fax is, people? Look it up. So I faxed it. And a few days after he got the fax, he called me and he said, I thought I should call you immediately. There's something I must tell you really urgently. I've just read your letter. He said, Jesus, you really shouldn't drink. So I'll just end, you know, the promises of the fifth step certainly came true for me. You know, I was able to look the world in the eye. I was certainly delighted. My fears were not there anymore. I truly began to feel like I was near the Creator. I was nearer to God than I'd ever been before, because I'd taken the crud off my soul. I'd taken the initial crud off my soul, and I was nearer to God. The feeling that the drink problem had disappeared, that was there for me from when I did the third step. That was a gift. I haven't wanted a drink of thought since the 10th of August 1984. What a gift. And I did feel like I was beginning to feel the consciousness of the presence of God. Who wouldn't want to do this step? And you know, when we go back home, we're going to take down the book from the shelf, and then we're going to do the other stuff that we have to do. But I'll finish with this, talking about transformation. My sons, who suffered from my alcoholism the most, and who my eldest son had made the decision at 11 that he didn't want to be with me anymore, and told his daddy all about me and all the things I'd done to him. He told me that he'd been visiting his father in Jamaica a couple of years ago, and his father and him were talking about my alcoholism. And my son said to his father, he said, "You know, when my mother was drinking, I used to look in my mother's eyes and nobody was there." He said, "But what has happened to my mother is nothing less than transformational." And that's what I believe, the transformation that occurs. Thank you for having me here. I'm so delighted to be here.